This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. In the late 1990s, migrant farm workers in Mount Olive, North Carolina, needed a revolution. So they called on a revolutionary named Baldomar Velasquez. Complaints by laborers that Mount Olive Pickle Company about unfair wages and unsafe living conditions were all too familiar to Baldomar. More than 40 years ago, he founded the Farm Labor Organizing Committee. That labor union led thousands of workers in a strike against Campbell's Soup Company in 1978. They successfully sued the Ohio Highway Patrol for racial profiling nearly 20 years later. As for that situation in Mount Olive, Baldomar organized a five-year boycott. The effort included a four-day, 70-mile march from Mount Olive to Raleigh. It worked. The Farm Labor Organizing Committee, or FLOC, negotiated a collective bargaining agreement in 2004. It was the first time an American labor union represented guest workers. Now FLOC has the second headquarters. That second headquarters is in Dudley, North Carolina, and continues to fight for migrant workers. And I'm pleased to welcome FLOC President Baldomar Velasquez as my guest on the program this hour. Welcome to the program. Good to have you.
Thank you very much.
Farm labor is something you know inside out. You started in the fields as a kid yourself in Texas. Tell us about growing up there and working in the farms.
Well, most of the migrant workers that would migrate to the Midwest during the summer came from the Rio Grande Valley in South Texas. I was born in Farr, Texas, right next to, across the river from Reynosa. And those are very tough years, the 1950s, when my family was first recruited to come north to the tomato, cucumber, sugar beet fields of Ohio, Michigan, Indiana, Wisconsin. And we made the trek up from the south. In those days, there were no superhighways. There were just two-lane highways. And I remember in those early years as a child, our only transportation was the labor contractor, the crew leader that we called, that we had a flatbed truck with wooden sideboards and a canvas thrown over the top, and there'd be five, six, seven families crammed in the back, including my mom, dad, and my three brothers that were the first four of the nine children in the family, coming up in the back of those trucks. And those are the days of segregation. And so we remember seeing the black and white facilities, the drinking fountains, and us Mexicans, we didn't know what we were supposed to do. And we tried to avoid any controversy to not delay our trip getting to Ohio. But and then we couldn't use the bathrooms at the gas stations, so we had to stop at wooded areas. And when the truck would pull over, we knew there was a pit stop, and the women would go off in one direction, the men in another direction. And then we arrive in Ohio or Michigan and labor camps that they weren't technically labor camps. They were just abandoned chicken coops and barns that they, anything with a roof over it, that's where they put us in. So it was pretty arduous life. And but in those years, we didn't know any better. We thought that's the way life was. And we went out there and picked crops and hoed and did whatever we had to do to survive.
You said Mexican-American. You were born in the United States. Your father was born in Texas?
Yeah, my mom and dad were born in Texas. My grandparents came from San Luis Potosí, Mexico, mm-hmm. during the Mexican Revolution. And my mom and dad tried their hand at sharecropping in Texas. That didn't work. And so they went into the migrant stream to follow crops to try to survive.
Now, you said that this was just sort of the ground you walked on, that this is just what we did. How did they explain? I mean, did it feel difficult to you, and did they have to explain that this is – because you're obviously seeing people living other ways, or did you see people living other ways?
No, actually, you didn't. You knew that the white farmer, that there was this white society out there, but that wasn't our reality. Our reality were the Mexican people, and all the Mexican people we knew, they were all in these labor camps and fields and crops, and that's what we knew. We collectivized our work in order to have our income just go to one pot, to feed ourselves. And in many cases, we were just working to feed ourselves. We got stranded in Ohio. We didn't make enough money to get back and pay the crew leader the fee to transport us back, and we didn't realize how cold it got up north. And so we, the first winter I remember very vividly, I was like 6 years old. We moved into the kitchen of this old farmhouse because the only heat source was the oven from the stove. And I didn't know any English at the time, so I started going to school in the winter because it was warm in the schoolhouse and cold at home. And by the end of the winter, I picked up a few words in English and so on. And then we had to work for free the entire summer to pay off the debts that, from my dad, to borrowing money from farmers just to stay alive. And then stay another winter to get in debt again, and then another summer to work it off. And it was we were sort of stuck there for like 6-7 years before we myself and my two older brothers grew big enough to earn more income and collectively and get out of debt. And finally, we moved out of there and were able to go back to Texas to visit my family. So
what kind of here you are? I mean, everybody's working full time, and you don't have enough money to pay for heat or even a ride home.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what kind of work were you doing up in Ohio?
We're picking crops.
Yeah. Like what kind of crops?
Everything, tomatoes, cucumbers. We did some peaches up in the Port Clinton area. We'd migrate over to Michigan to harvest cherries and strawberries, and sometimes stay in the fall, do it for the apple crop in Michigan, and then come back to Ohio. So that became kind of a routine every summer. As soon as towards the end of the school year, we started blocking sugar beets. It's thinning them after the planting. And there was a lot of work in the hoeing in the spring. And we'd go right into the cherries up in Michigan, preceded by a week of strawberries. And then we'd come back for the second hoeing and the sugar beets, right into the cucumber crop, and then right into the tomato crop and anything else to pick. My family were good pickers, so we were pretty in demand. We collectivized our money to go into the winter.
How big a group? You say collectivized the money. How big a group was part of that collective?
Well, mom and dad and first the four of us brothers, and then my two sisters, and then my younger brothers that came along later. At one time, there was maybe 7 or 8 of us.
Just within the family.
Within the family. That's what I meant.
So when did you – I understand that you were 12 when you organized your first protest. Is that about right?
Oh, it was a disaster. I was trying to be the best picker in the crew. We were picking tomatoes, and this one guy was making about 200 hampers a day. It's this 33-pound basket of tomatoes. We were getting paid 10 cents actually 12 cents, but 2 cents was kept back to force us to finish the crop when we get that at the end of the year. And during the meantime, we'd get the 10 cents. And this guy was picking 200, I was picking like 130, 135 hampers a day. And I said, how does this guy making that much more than I am when my hands are moving as fast as is? So I had observed him one day that he had the rows right next to the truck lanes. And when you fill the hamper, you're supposed to move it over to the truck lane for loading it in the afternoon. And I said, well, tomorrow I'm going to come early and get those rolls right up next to the truck lane. Well, I showed up there. The crew leader comes up an hour after I'd started, and he said, hey, move over. These rolls are designated for his favorite picker. And he made me move 30, 40 rolls into the field. So what was happening, I was wasting all this time hauling full hampers to the edge of the row from my picking spot. And so I said, well, wait a minute, I'm getting paid 10 cents to fill these things, not for hauling them. So I was a little smart, Alec. I said, I'm just going to leave them where I'm filling them and leave them there. And that's what I'm getting paid for. I'm doing my job. So at the end of the day, I hit about 170 that first day. And I said, man, I'm going to hit 200 tomorrow. The crew leader comes up and tells my dad, tell your son to move these hampers to the loading rows. And I shot back without even thinking. I said, you pay me for it because I don't work for free for hauling them over there, because I had 170 scattered all over the field. And I said, I'm not going to do that for free. And, immediately he fired me and the family and the whole crew. And I said, this is a disaster.
What'd your father say about that?
Well, he stuck by me. He said, you're my son. I know what you're doing, but you need to think this through next time you do something like that. And I said, oh, you're right. And what I learned from that, I said, if we did this all together, he wouldn't be able to find a replacement crew tomorrow, because every crew leader jealously guarded their own workers. That's how, the way they made their money. Right. And I said, if we did it all together, he'd have to do something about the hauling of those tomatoes to the edge of the row. And so I kept that in the back of my mind in my little notebook of experiences. So when I started organizing farm workers, I always indicated looked at what possible retaliation there might be.
And how to keep people together, because it does seem to me that that system was designed to create a kind of a competition and enmity between you guys. I mean, it was clear to you that some workers get favored and others don't. Pretty hard to organize and get people together after you've had that feeling about a guy working two rows down from you.
Yeah, but it could be resolved by compensating the people for all that hauling time. I mean, that's the way I thought it might be good to do it that way, so...
Well, we'll find out more about your ideas and how you did come to organize farm workers when our conversation with Baldemar Velasquez continues. He is the founder and president of FLOC, the Farm Labor Organizing Committee. Our conversation continues on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. There are more than 100,000 migrant and seasonal farm workers in North Carolina. Most are from Mexico and other Latin American countries. They work, and the work they do contributes more than $2 billion to the state's economy. But farm worker families are more likely than any other racial or ethnic group to live in poverty, according to researchers at East Carolina University. This structural imbalance is something my guest has worked on all his life. Baldemar Velasquez is the founder and president of FLOC, Farm Labor Organizing Committee. FLOC is based in Ohio, but they've got headquarters here in North Carolina and have since the late 1990s. Baldemar, let's talk about this. When we talk about a migrant worker, who is that? Well, what do we mean? How do you define that term?
Well, first of all, agriculture is different than just about any other industry. Many of the crops are short-term, and there's a labor void there. Somebody has to fill it, and that's normally filled by the most desperate of workers trying to survive, and it happened to be our families when we, you know, it's changed considerably because the migrancy among U.S. workers has transitioned quite a bit. Maybe in large part to the success of advocates of finding educational opportunities for kids, and the civil rights movement has had a lot of impact on the Latino migrant workforce that are American citizens, the civil rights. So there's been more opportunities opened up for that group. And to come across the country with a family for short-term crops is now not that feasible for the families anymore. And then, of course, there's been an expansion of low-wage jobs in the retail industry and also in fast food restaurants and so on. So many of the kids are staying to help their parents in South Texas and other places in that way. But that void is being filled by more workers that are desperate from further away. So they migrate from Mexico for the integration of the North American economy through the trade deals like NAFTA and so on that did not take into effect, into account the displacement that will take place. We've displaced 6 million corn farmers in Mexico with our opening up the corn market there. And it's been to the benefit of our farmers, corn farmers in the United States, who are highly subsidized. And the Mexican farmers cannot compete with that. So we displace them, and now we're complaining about them coming across our border to try to survive. So these are the migrant workers now. To me, the border, whether the border is North Carolina border to the Kentucky border, the Tennessee border to the Ohio border, or the Mexican border, the borders are borders. It doesn't impede the supply and demand economics in the labor market.
Well, capital and commodities flowed freely under the new organization, under the new agreements. Labor did not. You couldn't take your work as a commodity and be as free with that as you could with your dollar.
Well, I've argued that in the past, that we ought to practice what we preach in the market. So if you want to you want a free trade, well, then you should, you want free markets. Well, then the labor market is a market too. You ought to let that be free and let the workers migrate within the treaty countries freely and let the market saturate itself and with labor rights.
You talked about education earlier, the fact that you went to school at first just to stay warm, but you managed to get an education and you went to the University of Texas. Tell us about your education and how did you do that? It sounds like you were working the whole time. Was your education, your elementary and secondary education, regular, or was it episodic because of the growing season?
We'd lose some weeks in the beginning and the end of the school year because of the crops. But by the third or fourth grade, I had learned enough English to understand what the teacher was talking about. So I was a CD student, I'd say, just getting by until my junior high years in the seventh grade, when I was trying to – all children want to belong to the group. We all want to be able to – well, everyone wants to be accepted and be made useful. Kids growing up like this, when you're discriminated against, it's tough to break that barrier and try to get into the groups. That's the way it was in school. So I went out for sports, which I found you could get respect from others if you were good in sports. I worked really hard on everything. I went out for everything, baseball, football, track. And one day after a football game, I'd done pretty good. I'd scored three or four touchdowns in one game because I was playing halfback, both on offense and defense. Until this kid comes up to me after the game, he said, "Well, Velasquez, you're a pretty good football player, but look at your grades. You're still a dumb Mexican." So I was really angry, but, you know, the guy did me a favor because I took a dictionary from the school library, and I looked up every word that I did not understand while I was reading my lessons or my history. And I had a history test coming up the following week. I aced it because I stayed up till 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning reading and looking up words in that dictionary. And I did that the rest of my school year, and I was on the honor roll by the end of the year. And I stayed that way, and I kept that dictionary and kept building my vocabulary just by looking words up that I read that I didn't understand. And then went through high school, and I didn't even think about going to college until my high school literature teacher asked me where I was going my senior year. I said, "I thought college was for white kids." And he said, "Well, your grades are good enough." So by the time I started looking into a college I could go to, the only one I could afford to is go back in Texas to Pan American College, which is now part of the University of Texas system. It was an independent school at that time. I could live with my grandparents and hitchhike to school every morning. So that's why I got through my first year of undergraduate school.
What were you planning to do? Now, you hadn't even planned to go to college. Now you're there. What were you going to
do? Well, I was good in math, and because I'd been counting tomato hampers from the time I could walk. And I was good with numbers, and I was going to be an engineer. And it was a good science school. And I loved science. The astronomy was my science requirement in my freshman year. And NASA used Pan American as one of its Earth-based satellites tracking stations at that time. So our lab was to go out Wednesday nights at the telescope that they had out in the desert and photograph the lights that were blinked by NASA over the satellite going over these coordinates. And I was just fascinated. But being in South Texas, you couldn't escape the obvious discrimination against Latinos. And I watched the way my grandparents and my aunts were being treated down there that I was living with. I saw that, something's got to change here. And then I began to learn about the civil rights movement. Now, this is 1965, 1966. It was right the heart of the fight at that time. And so I was observed of that, and I played guitar music. I was playing Mexican folk music, so the white folk musician would want me to come sing Mexican songs at their folk music concerts.
Ah, you were discovered.
I discovered them because there was a lot of protest music in those days, and it helped politicize me when I combined my experience with the civil rights. I said, this is something that I got to take a different look at.
And did you do that? Did you pursue that through college then, change your major?
Well, I changed my major to social sciences my second year, so I transferred back to Ohio, to Ohio Northern University my sophomore year. I had a friend, the Mexican-American lawyer in Toledo, that that was a farm worker at one time, and he was a graduate of Ohio Northern. He hooked me up with a Catholic priest there that helped me get the financial aid to transfer to Ohio Northern, which I got involved in the student rights movement there and civil rights. I spent my winter vacations working for the Congress of Racial Equality in Cleveland in the Huff section. I lived in a tenement house with an African-American, and I was riding shotgun with another fellow that we had a police scanner in the car, and our job was to document police brutality cases in the black community. And I'd go up to that tenement house and sleep up there with the rats every night. And the guy, my host, asked me at breakfast one morning. He says, how come you haven't complained about the rats? You're the only volunteer I ever had here that hasn't complained about the rats. I said, well, I grew up with the rats, and my younger brother and I used to play with the rats. We didn't have any toys or money to buy toys, so we made games with the rats. He said, well, how's that? He said, well, we lived in our bed was the living room couch. It's just like the couch that I'm sleeping on here in your place. And it was up against a window that had a broken pane underneath the window. That's where the rats would come in, and they'd sort of scratch themselves out the back of that couch. And when we'd hear that scratching, we knew that there was a rat up there that had to jump on the seat that we were sleeping on to get to the floor. So when we'd hear that scratching, we'd kick each other and to pull the blanket taut to make it like a trampoline. And the when the rat hit the blanket, we'd with our fists, would bang up the blanket and try to make the rat fly to the other side of the room. And that was our game, see how far we could make the rats fly. And he says to me, well, good Lord, son, you know, why aren't you doing something for your own people? What are you doing here?
Well, were you thinking about that? Were you thinking about discrimination and farm work at the time? Because certainly what you're doing is different now. This is a whole a kind of the urban view of civil rights. Were you thinking about farm work at the time?
Yes and no, because I was still working in the fields in those days. Wow. I'd go back in the summer and or even after school when I got to Bluffton College, which is then I could live at home my last 2 years. After school, I'd go out and help the family finish the picking for the day. I'd go to my classes, and if there was a break in school, I'd be out there working with them, you know, finishing the crops in the fall and in the spring helping them out. And then all summer, I was with the family working in the fields or migrating back up to Michigan and doing cherries during the summer and coming back.
Were you talking with them about your ideas about civil rights and human rights at this point?
Well, not until 1967. I remember that's the year we founded the organization. I asked my dad's permission if I could hitchhike up to Traverse City to pick some cherries and make enough money to pay a loan that I from a local bank that I had for school. And I said, I want to study what it would take to organize me if someone was coming to the camp and organizing me. So I took a little portable typewriter with me, and every night after picking cherries, I'd come to my little, actually it was a shed with a dirt floor. I was living in there in that labor camp, and I'd type up my notes. I'd ask myself the question all day, if somebody walked into this orchard to organize me, what would it take for me to say yes, or into the labor camp where I'm at? What would be the possible retaliation? What would be the threats, and what would be the advantages? How could we put things? So all summer I kept notes, and that fall I had heard about this guy organizing pickle workers in Wisconsin, Jesse Salas, a group called Obreros Unidos, and I hadn't heard about Cesar Chavez at that time yet. Jesse Salas, the one that told me about the United Farm Workers or organizing committee at that time. And so I began to drink up all of this information from him, and I hitchhiked after the cherry episode. I stowed away in a boat in Ludington, Michigan, across the lake, because I didn't want to hitchhike all the way around Chicago to get to Wisconsin. So I stowed away on a boat with the help of another student whose father owned one of those ships that he was working on for the summer. I just happened to befriend him at the port in Ludington, and he said, I'll get you over there, because I didn't have enough money to pay the ticket to get over there. Yeah. So I went over there, and I learned. I spent a week with the Obreros Unidos, and they're organizing over there, and I brought it right back to Ohio, and we started the Farm Labor Organizing Committee with my mom and dad. their circle of friends, his compadres, my mom's comadres. My mom was the most effective because those women were really well organized through their church prayer groups. My mom was one of these charismatic Catholics who a lot of times put the Pentecostals to shame when it comes to their worship service. I mean, they're pretty wild.
They get noisy.
They get noisy. But my mom and her comadres, she had a prayer group that any time the women got together, of course, the men had to be there. So it made it easy to get that first core of that. We were all working in the field, so it was pretty convenient to bring our first group together.
And what was the first major battle?
Well, I mistakenly thought that we could fashion the Farm Labor Organizing Committee after the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. That all we had to do is tell the appropriate authorities how the laws were being violated and not in compliance with housing regulations and sanitation codes and minimum wage violations and children, child labor and all of that. So all we had to do, report it to the authority, they'd come in and enforce the law, right? Well, I was wrong. And I said, this is not going to work. This enforcement strategy is not going to work. One guy from the Department of Labor from the Wage and Hour Division told me, hey, you can't. We only have two officers for this entire office in Cleveland. We can't be out at every nook and cranny of every farm in Ohio. And so I saw the writing on the wall that enforcement was not going to make it. So then by that time, I'd learned enough about unions to say, well, then I went to every labor union in Northwest Ohio. None of them wanted to organize agricultural workers. Their argument was, it's too short term. You can't economically sustain a union with dues only coming, you know, for 5 weeks or 6 weeks out of a year. How are you going to establish a union? Well, we didn't know. We didn't know any better. So
you're about 20 years old at this time, right?
Exactly.
All right. So Now you're checking in with the unions, trying to figure out a way to organize. What happens next?
So we said, well, I guess we'll have to organize one of our own. And so we started organizing. I mean, it was all volunteer. The first 10 years of Flock, I never got compensated for anything. No wages, no nothing. And I had to find part-time jobs to, you know, to make ends meet, pay gas, and, you know, pay rent. And I was married in 1969, so we had to make a home, and we found a cheap place to live. And I'd work odd jobs. I repaired furniture, refinished furniture. I was pretty good at that, and I worked in the docks in Toledo on weekends. But all that was to support the work that the organization.
How big was the organization at the start, and what was the first target?
Our first target were farmers in eastern Lucas County. Mm-hmm. We wanted to negotiate an additional 5 cents a basket for the 33-pound baskets because the wages had been stagnant for years. And the cucumbers, the price of pickles had not been raised for I think the price of number ones only went up $2.50 in 26 years for every 100 pounds. And
The price paid to workers, you're saying, or the price, the retail price? Or
that's
wholesale
what
price.
They paid the farmer.
Oh, I see.
And so, the farmer had to split that wage with the workers who did the picking. It was a 50-50 split, whatever value of cucumbers you picked. And the tomatoes hadn't gone up more than 3 cents in 20 years. That's for 33 pounds of tomatoes. Wow. That was a lot of tomatoes for a few pennies. So we were striking for a couple more pennies a basket, and we successfully shut down tomato production in eastern Lucas County in 1968 and actually won our first little agreements with those farmers. But we immediately recognized that their margin of profit was so limited that if we dug substantially in that profit margin, it'd be just as profitable for them to grow corn, wheat, and soybeans because they were all diversified in that way. And this is where it just sort of hit me between the eyes. I said, we got to go to the companies that buy these tomatoes. They're the guys setting the price. They pay the farmer per ton, and the break even. I remember doing the because I was going to be an engineer. I was good at crunching numbers.
Right.
The break even point for a farm, he had to get 16 tons an acre out of every acre of tomatoes to break even, and anything over that was a profit. And a lot of these guys were averaging 17, 18 tons an acre. And I said, how are we going to cut into that profit margin to substantially increase our wages? And I said, it's not going to work.
So that's what got you thinking about Campbell's Soup?
That's right. And I said, Campbell's has got to raise that price. And they said, well, the market is going to demand that. Well, I mean, the cost of production should demand what the price is, and taking our lives into consideration. And if we don't, we'll continue to subsidize everybody else's existence.
We'll talk more about that fight with Campbell's and Mount Olive Pickles when my conversation continues with Baldomar Velasquez, president of FLOC, the Farm Labor Organizing Committee. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio. My guest this hour, Baldomar Velasquez, president of FLOC, Farm Labor Organizing Committee, advocates for migrant workers here in North Carolina. Okay, so you successfully organize a strike that brings higher price for tomato pickers in Lucas County. Then you realize that those growers aren't in much better situation than you are. So go to the retailer. Let's go to the Campbell's Soup that really sets the price for this. What were you thinking? It's a large corporation. How did you imagine the strategy against Campbell's?
Well, first of all, that's where my math training came in good. When I had probably the best high school math teachers anywhere, and she taught us how to see the entire picture. She not only taught us how to use formulas, the Pythagorean theorem and all of that, she taught us how it was constructed in the first place and the reason, and how that way we could understand how to apply it. So it was easy to break down the economics of tomato production and the price per ton that the company paid. We reasoned that if you increase the price of a can of soup for a half a penny, you could quadruple the wages of the farm workers if it was passed down directly into the chain. And but the other thing that we pioneered that was very important, that we understood the need of the farmer, the predicament of that small farmer. And it's been popularized in movies and so on, the survival of the small family farm. Well, these are the guys whose farms we came to work on. So we quickly realized that if we don't do something to sustain those farms, we're not going to have a place to come and work. So our survival depends on their survival. And so all the more reason why we have to get to the top of the supply chain. The manufacturers, they control the planning. They issue very restrictive contracts in terms of what seeds to use, what kind of plants to use, how to cultivate it, you know, what to spray it with, when to spray it. I mean, they dictate all that down to the farmer, and therefore dictating the parameters from which farm workers and farmers have to negotiate and talk about anything. So it made perfect sense to us to go up to the supply chain and say, no, we want to talk to you. Now, this was the 80s. Everybody thought we were crazy. I went to the top leaders in the labor movement in Washington, and they told me flat out, I said, Baldomar, you're beating your head up against a brick wall. Campbell Soup is never going to talk to you or negotiate an agreement with a group of people that are not their employees. They're stuck on this employer-employee right. business. Well, after an eight-year fight with Campbell's, we convinced them to do exactly what everybody said they never
did. How did that
do.
Fight work? What's the strategy?
To get everybody around the bargaining table.
But why do they do that? Because they do math, too. So they say a half penny a can makes me less competitive with Lipton. No, I'm not going to do that. Plus, I know if you say no, there's about 20 people behind you who'll go pick that stuff. So I'm doing that math as well. I'm Campbell's. I don't need to talk to you. What made them? What leverage? What pressure could you bring to bear?
Well, we knew that the Campbell's would not listen to us, the farm workers. So we went after the people that they would listen to. We went after their bankers. We went after their board of directors and their businesses. We went after Philadelphia National Bank. We went after spot targets that were the more lucrative companies, like what's the name of the company that does all the sweetbreads?
Like Hostess or one of those things?
Well, they had a subsidiary. I'm trying to remember what that subsidiary was, but that was a high profit company.
So when you say go after, let me just interrupt the train of thought for a minute. What do you mean go after? What pressure can you bring those boards of directors, those banks, those suppliers,
we
and
did
retailers?
What the farm worker movement has always done successfully, we appeal to the American consumer. And I am convinced that the American people have a sense of fair play. You can hoodwink them, you know, for some time and play off people's ignorance. But once they get the facts and see the equations, the majority of the American people have a sense of fair play, and they'll side with you. And they will respond to saying you shouldn't buy this product because of this, this, and this.
So you can bring the threat of a boycott to board members of Campbell's who have their own big businesses, or they wouldn't be on that board.
Yeah, well, that's exactly what we did. The company I was thinking about is Pepperidge Farms.
Oh, yeah.
Very popular in the suburbs of the large cities. So we targeted some of those, and we're quite successful getting consumers to complain to Pepperidge Farm about Campbell's. But probably the most damaging campaign we did to them was the Philadelphia National Bank. That was the company's bank. They held a 1.8 million shares of stock in a trust for one of the Dorrance family members, the major stockholders at Campbell's Soup. We went after that bank. They issued the dividend checks to the shareholders. They were owned by Core States. So we went to their shareholders meeting with our own alternative report documenting the abuses that they are investing and they're banking on child labor, that we raised the child labor issue and introduced the nation to the real Campbell's kids. You know, their commercials, these two little chubby kids selling soup. Well, we published pictures of kids picking tomatoes in the fields of Ohio. So these are the real Campbell's kids. And they actually ran ads against us in the major, some of the major newspapers around the country. But we boycotted. We got consumers to start boycotting the Philadelphia National Bank, withdrawing their funds from that bank. We did a three-month campaign in Philadelphia, the home site of the bank. And I think within the 2 months, we organized something like $18 million to withdraw on a single day to initiate a divestment campaign at the bank. And that was very forceful. The bank itself came out on the front page of the business section of the Philadelphia Inquirer telling Campbell's to settle this dispute with the Mexicans in Ohio. And so that was quite successful. So the bank didn't, the Campbell's never listened to us. They listened to the important people that
and you
they
got
did
to each
business
of them.
With.
So tell us about Mount Olive Pickles and how you came to North Carolina.
Well, we felt that that was the only major pickle company that we didn't have an agreement with. We had labor agreements with Vlasic Pickle, Heinz USA, the Dean Foods. Their subsidiaries, Aunt Jane and Green Bay Foods. And when you study the pickle market, Mount Olive had the dominance on the grocery store shelves in the southeast of the United States, from Virginia down to Texas, from Florida up to Kentucky. And so we said we need to level the playing field here and try to raise the standards of those farm workers in North Carolina that compete against our people in Ohio and Michigan. So we brought the campaign down here, and we did a similar campaign with Mount Olive for 5 years. We were able then to negotiate a pretty interesting agreement with them. They didn't see the need to set up a separate association for their growers to facilitate an agreement with Flock, because they were already members of this North Carolina Grower Association. So talks between them and us led to this blockbuster agreement covering 7,000 workers on 600-700 family farms in North Carolina. So that got the door open for us here in North Carolina. And the problem with the agreement is that we did not have the participation of the main corporation, the main industry, in any talks like we had with Mount Olive. Mount Olive did raise its prices under the agreement with Flock to compensate growers, to have workers' compensation and a few other things. But we're talking about not just 70, 60 cucumber growers. We're talking 700, 600 farms in North Carolina, mostly tobacco. And so we have to inject the interest of the tobacco companies to really raise the conditions, not only for the farm workers, but for the farmers that grow their tobacco. And these tobacco farmers, many of them are diversified in several other crops. For instance, the 7,000 workforce that come to, with the North Carolina Growers Association with this visa, work visa from Mexico, they harvest 32 different crops, not just tobacco. Mm.
So is this what happened then? The Mount Olive Agreement led to a more comprehensive view of farming in North Carolina. It was a different way of approaching organization here. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of like I said, if we really want to help the farmers here and sustain their ability to operate and therefore guaranteeing job sites for our people, that we need to have the big tobacco companies involved.
So this led to the fight now with R.J. Reynolds Tobacco. Tell us about that.
Exactly. So we targeted R.J. Reynolds and or Reynolds America, and we've been at them for 5 years to get them to duplicate what we've done to solve problems at the bottom of supply chains and agriculture, like we did with Campbell Soup and Heinz and Dean Foods in Ohio. I laid out the scope of what we want to address.
And tell us about some of those. What are some of the issues with tobacco farming?
It's not only tobacco farming, it's all of it, agriculture. Mm-hmm. Like I said, many of those farms are diversified. They grow sweet potatoes, they grow cucumbers, they grow not just tobacco. There are three areas. The first is, of course, the worker's ability to complain without fear of retaliation. We workers that get heat stroke every summer. Some have died. They need to be able to do that successfully. We have that right under – we have a very good relationship with the Growers Association here. They're very good employers. I can't say enough about how righteously they stood up and did what a lot of people didn't want them to do, and that's recognize a union. So that took a lot of courage on their part. I give them so much credit for them to do that. But that's only 7,000 out of 140,000 farm workers in the state. So there's this fear of retaliation. We published a report jointly with Oxfam America documenting official human rights abuses in the North Carolina tobacco fields. And 90% of the workers are undocumented. And so they need to guarantee the rights of the people to be able to complain without fear of retaliation, get medical help when they need it on those farms, particularly where there's undocumented workers. And then there's two other areas. One is the squalor in the labor camps. You cannot protect the workers' health and safety unless you got decent facilities for them to bathe and wash and to clean all that tobacco residues off their bodies and off their clothes. So if you don't have good facilities, all the education you do on green tobacco sickness is going to go to naught.
Well, let me just briefly, green tobacco sickness is pretty serious. What is that?
That's where you ingest the nicotine in your body just by working with the plant.
Yeah.
You harvest it. You do the suckering and topping and the leaves. I came and worked a week in the tobacco just to get the experience because I'd never done anything like tobacco. I picked and worked in every other kind of crop, but never anything like tobacco. So I did a 6-day work week here a few summers ago, and protecting yourself from the nicotine ingestion by, you know, wearing long sleeve shirts, cotton shirts so they could breathe, and wearing those ponchos made out of plastic trash bags in the morning, which if you feel like you're in an oven, even by 9 o'clock, right. It's hot and humid, and so. The dehydration is a very serious problem. Is you got to keep people hydrated, and then you got to get the nicotine off of you and keep from coming in contact with it. It's
so
impossible.
You're trying to attack the supply chain in the tobacco industry, for instance, with Reynolds. How does that work? What's the supply chain?
Well, they contract the crop to be grown to these small family farmers,
right.
And they're so marginal in their contracts,
right.
That the farmers only have so much money to pay their labor, to improve the conditions that they live and work, their labor camps. So when you marginalize a farmer, you marginalize the worker,
right.
And his existence in the supply chain. So you got to get their attention to help solve these problems.
And you're targeting the people, the distributors who distribute their stuff. Tell us about that.
Well, yeah. I mean, almost a third of the consolidated revenue of Reynolds comes through McLane Distribution. Their products are distributed across the country through that. And then, of course, the retailers that are customers of the McLane company are like the Wawa stores in the Northeast, the Kangaroo, the Pantry Kangaroo stores here in the South, and the 7-Eleven stores in the Midwest and West. So it all comes through the McLane Distribution. So we went after them, said, you guys are making money off the misery of these farm workers. You got to tell Reynolds to fix it. You're all part of the system.
They have 20 presidents across the country. You went and visited each and every one of them with a consortium of people from the faith community, labor community, and those groups went to all 20 presidents at once.
Yeah, we went simultaneously in a period of 2 or 3 days, and I did get a call from the McLane guy in Texas, and he said, I've received information from three of my presidents, and I think I'm going to hear from more of them. I said, yeah, you're going to hear from all of them. And we had a discussion about the supply chain issue, and he said, you bet I'm going to weigh in with Reynolds on this. So we know there's been some discussions.
So how's it going so far? Have they gotten back to Reynolds? And what are things like with
you? Well, after 5 years, Reynolds finally agreed to talk to us. So we had one meeting already with Reynolds. And the only thing I can tell you that the discussion was very positive and very amicable. So we'll see where we go from there.
You met Martin Luther King, and you had, and I've got about 20 seconds or 30 seconds to let you tell this story, but you met Martin Luther King, and what he said was pretty important to you when you were a young man.
I had just started my organizing career, and I get a telegram at Bluffton College, where I was going to school, to come to Atlanta and help plan the Poor People's Campaign. So the professors got a pool of, you know, collection going to get me a plane ticket. I go down there. I remember him walking into the room with Ralph Abernathy on one side and Andy Young on the other, and the young Jesse Jackson in tow. And we sat and had this phenomenal conversation the rest of the afternoon and evening. And sometime that evening, the talk came up about how do we as poor people who have nothing, we have no political power, have nothing, how do we compel the world's largest corporations and the richest people to sit down and talk to us as human beings about our plight in their businesses? He says, when you impede the rich man's ability to make money, anything is negotiable. And he was right.
Waldemar Velasquez, thanks so much. What a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you very much.
Waldemar Velasquez is the president of the Farm Labor Organizing Committee, offices in Toledo, Ohio, and Dudley, North Carolina. For more information about that organization, visit flock.com, FLOC.com. That's the state of things for today. Thanks for listening. This is North Carolina Public Radio, broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.